It's May 23rd, 2016, and you're listening to Monday Morning Meetings on Migration, a conversation about migration and politics at the University of Amsterdam. I'm Darshan Vigneshwaran, and today we're talking about a story that has been burning up Twitter and Facebook feeds over the past week. London has a new mayor, Sadiq Khan, and his Muslim and immigrant background have been front and centre of his attempts to introduce himself to the world, and also in some of his early encounters with presidential hopefuls across the pond. Engaging in a spat with Donald Trump over his plans to deny Muslims entry into the US if elected president. Now, we've been fortunate enough to have Professor John Bowen visiting us for the next month or so in Amsterdam. Hey, John.
Hey.
He's been studying Islam in Indonesian society since the 1970s and across a variety of European countries since. His most recent book, out with Princeton University Press, is titled On British Islam, Religion, Law, and Everyday Practice in Sharia Councils. John, there's not likely to be anyone better to have in the studio right now. A lot has been made of Khan's religious identity. Now, should this matter to us? And if so, why?
Well, of course, it should matter, because in some respects, it doesn't matter as much as it might have and would have, say, 20 years ago. It's sort of almost banal to have a Muslim person representing the City of London, since there are so many Muslims in the City of London, and so many of them are in professional capacity there. So having a Muslim mayor seems almost natural. Same time, of course, it's the first time. And of course, here in the Netherlands, you know this from Abu Talib's becoming the mayor of Rotterdam. That was hugely important also. But he's admired largely for his being an excellent mayor and being someone who communicates well with everybody. And I think the same is already, we're already seeing the same thing with Sadiq Khan.
Right. What is this telling us about the UK approach to diversity or the British approach to Islam? Is there anything distinctive about it? And if so, are there any differences from other national contexts?
Well, it tells us a lot about the British approach to diversity, which is basically, it's okay. Why not elect a mayor who's a Muslim? Why not elect one who's a Sikh or a Hindu or is from any other country in the world or who has parents from any other country in the world? Things, this becomes sort of banal there. I also work in France, and there, of course, these issues are anything but banal. It's very difficult for me to imagine a Muslim being elected mayor of any large city there anytime soon, because there's this sense that everybody should be the same, and how do you know this person's going to be the same as everywhere else? Whereas the British philosophy is that we flourish in our differences.
Right. And how would you contrast that with the French? I mean, we had on the show, I guess, a few weeks ago, almost a month ago, François Bonnet, who was very much defending this idea that the French attitude towards racism is and their willingness and motivation to perform non-racism is particularly strong. But your approach suggests that may not be the case?
Well, it's certainly, in the literal sense, accurate to say that the French pride themselves on performing non-racism. The question is, how deep does that performance go? You can't talk about race in France, and you can talk about it quite openly in much of the rest of Europe, but especially in Britain, where in fact long before Islam became an issue, it was all about race. It was about being Pakistani, black, which meant West Indian, and that sort of thing. You know, I'm not interested in judging or handing out prizes first, second, and third for toleration to different Western European countries. The French have their own approach, and it's always going to be their own approach. It's based on republicanism, the notion that basically citizens should be treated as all the same. And so you should never bring up differences in public fora. But the problem with that approach is that these differences are deeply felt by individuals and deeply felt by others who are different than they are. So it just doesn't work very well to try to cover it over. The British approach is to say, let's celebrate that and allow headscarves and whatever in public life. It really is much less of a problem. I think the jury's out, if it will ever be back in, on which approach is better to dealing with things like extremism. On the one hand, the French, partly because they spy on every Friday prayer all over the country, they find out about and quickly get rid of any sermon givers in mosques who say radical things. That's not at all the case in Britain, and who knows whether that's good or bad. For a long time, the British thought their approach was better because allowing people to speak was providing a safety valve. It could get things out, and then people could respond, and this would reduce tensions, but that's not really worked so strikingly well either. And the French thought their approach was best because it made sure that everybody was speaking in a fairly harmonious way. That's not worked so well either. The Dutch approach, we could talk about that, I suppose, hasn't worked so well either. There's plenty of Dutch Muslims fighting in Syria. So there really are, right now we know of no winners in Western Europe in terms of keeping down extremism.
Now, in the book, you pick up on this issue and you draw it down into the history of British institutions. How have you explored that specifically in your research in order to come out with what is distinctively British in its approach to Islam?
Right. Well, this is important for understanding the approach to Islam or to any of these issues for any country. You have to look at where they've come from, because there are deep national patterns that shape everything that happens. Not completely determined, but certainly shape. These often have to do with colonial experiences. Certainly in the British case, the way that the British govern diversity in South Asia, in today's India, Pakistan, Bangladesh, is crucial in shaping their way that they think and talk about diversity in Britain today. For example, one of the most striking parts of this, or examples of this, is the way that in South Asia, the British gave legal religious recognition to distinct religious groups. So Muslims got to have many of their private matters resolved through what was called Anglo-Mohammedan law. This was a British attempt to take Islam and reduce it to basically a book that an administrator of any faith could use and just administer. Same for different versions of Hinduism, etc. This means that the British were already very used to giving each of these religious groups the right to conduct, for example, marriages and divorces according to their own backgrounds. And that's basically what they do in Britain today, but it comes out of that colonial experience.
Now, this emphasis on history and institutions contrasts with a lot of the sort of work that we see at the moment, which look, and a lot of your colleagues in the discipline of anthropology, that want us to focus on the imminent, the ephemeral, things that are happening on the streets and every day. The work of Asher Min, for example, in his work Land of Strangers, he looks at how everyday interactions between Muslims and non-Muslims on the streets result in problematic encounters. And he gives a very different portrait of British society than, I guess, the one that you do. How do you account for some of these contrasts?
Well, in terms of methodology, what you're describing really goes back to people like Irving Goffman in sociology. He talked about the interaction order, that an awful lot grows out of interactions. And, of course, that's absolutely true. If you look at a school in London today, for example, just to pick an example out of the air, a lot is going to be generated out of interactions among students, between students and teachers, et cetera. But that isn't to say that the framework for setting up schools in the first place doesn't have a deep historical set of causes behind it. So you have to do both. But if you're going to understand why interactions take the shape they do, you have to understand what set up the institution in the first place.
Okay, that makes total sense. I want to close by talking about bringing us back to Sadiq Khan and his claim that he may not be, he doesn't want to be recognized necessarily as a Muslim mayor. He says, "Let me make it clear, I'm not a Muslim leader or a Muslim spokesperson. I really am not. I'm the mayor of London." And I want to ask you, do you think that he'll be able to hold up to that claim? Or will he be forced to assume a different mantle? I mean, we've already seen in his spat with Donald Trump, in the way he's been represented in some comedy programs in Italy, in the way in which he himself is presenting himself to the world, that this idea that he should be the spokesman for Islam is going to be hard to avoid. What do you think is going to play out?
Well, I agree with him, and I must say I'm looking forward to those Italian programs that represent him in particular ways. No, I think he's absolutely right. And of course, the fact that he's a Muslim is a large part of what people talk about now, because it is symbolic of the fact that it doesn't matter, that you can be a Muslim and nonetheless be elected mayor of London. But the fact that it doesn't matter is really important. I mean, he campaigned, after all, one of his major issues. I think his major issue was social housing. That's what he's going to work on. I don't know what a Muslim issue would be for London. It would be giving people, many of whom can't afford housing, many of whom are Muslims, good housing, but that benefits all sorts of people. Now, I think he's going to continue doing that. He's never been interested, as far as I know, in talking, in being a spokesperson for Islam. And he's going to be a spokesperson for people who need help in London, who include Muslims and Christians and others. The spat with Donald Trump, of course, lots of people can pick on Donald Trump for some of these things he said, especially the not admitting any Muslims. Of course, it strikes home more personally at Sadiq Khan. But just bear in mind, what he was reacting to was, all right, it was the general claim, we're not going to let in any Muslims. But it was then saying, but I'll make an exception for this sort of guy. And for many people, it's sort of like, well, you know, there's a problem with blacks, except the one I know, there are good blacks, that sort of a thing. And it sounded very much like the sort of patronizing old-style racism, which is how I understand it. And I think Sadiq Khan's reaction was great.
Thanks, John. Those are some really punchy and insightful comments on what's happening right now in the position of the London mayor. For those of you interested in finding out more about John's research, you can find links to his staff page and links to a sample of his work at our blog, forumpodcast.com. Monday Morning Meetings on Migration is run by the Institute for Migration and Ethnic Studies at the University of Amsterdam. You can access us through iTunes or Stitcher and subscribe for updates on Twitter and Facebook. As always, if you have suggestions about a story you'd like us to feature or would like to post an audio rejoinder to something that's been said on a previous podcast, please send us an email at imes@uva.nl.